Stone asked.
Not until now. Meg, this is Mr. Owazu. It's Owaki. How do you do, Miss Harmon?
I do very well, thank you, Meg replied.
I should tell you, Mr. Owachi, Stone said, that neither Miss Harmon nor I are accustomed to doing business outside our offices, which are located on another continent.
I am aware of that, Owaki said, and I apologize for the inconvenience.
Actually, it is less of an inconvenience than an intrusion. Do you normally call on those to whom you have not been introduced and with whom you do not have an appointment to discuss business?
I am sorry, Owaki said, but since the matter is one favorable to Miss Harmon and rather time-sensitive, I took a chance.
And what did you hope to achieve by taking this chance? Stone asked.
I wish to buy something from Miss Harmon, and if she is not willing to sell, then perhaps sell her something.
Well, what are you buying and selling, Mr. Onako? Encyclopedias? Pots and pans? Bibles, perhaps?
Meg spoke up. I haven't the faintest idea what he's talking about, Stone. Do you?
Not a clue, Stone replied. Mr. Tanaka, please enlighten us.
Owaki sighed. I wish to buy Harmony software, he said, and I'm prepared to pay a rich price.
Perhaps you are not aware that a substantial minority of the shares of Harmony software have already been purchased by the Steel Group, and they are not inclined to sell.
But you have not heard my offer.
That is so, but I am a member of the board of the Steel Group and their attorney. And if you wish, I will convey your offer to its chairman, Mr. Steele.
I do not wish to buy the Steele Group's shares, Owaki said. I wish to buy Miss Harmon's 51%.
Did you have a figure in mind?
Stone asked.
Meg raised a hand. Stone, will you please convey to this gentleman that my shares in Harmony Software are not for sale to him?
Mr. Owaku, Stone said, Miss Harmon's shares are not for sale to you.
Do you mean specifically not for sale or not for sale to me? Owaki asked.
Not for sale to you, Meg replied.
May I ask why not? Owaki said.
Because, Stone raised a hand. Let me take this one, please, Meg.
Of course, Stone.
Miss Harmon will not sell her shares to you, Mr. Opatu, because you are a merchant of death, the murderer, and, generally speaking, devoid of any moral character.
Owaki was bright red now.
I do not understand, he said. I thought I was perfectly clear, Mr. Olio. Now, you said you have something to sell?
Owaki shifted in his seat and tried to recover his good humor.
I own, just a few miles from this house, 25 acres of land, and on it, a factory building of some 30,000 square feet, well equipped for the manufacturing of automobiles, and with a highly trained staff of some 300 people.
Very well, Mr. What's-Your-Name, Meg said. I will offer you £100,000, no, make that dollars, for your land and factory, she smiled. Take it or leave it.
Owaki's jaw dropped.
What?
Would you like me to repeat my offer? Meg asked.
Thank you, no. I had expected to have a business discussion with you people, and
you have done so, Stone replied.
So have we, and we are done now.
He pressed a button on the table beside him.
Owaki stood up, and he was seething.
You are about to learn that it is unwise to deal with me in such a manner.
Oh, we learned that several days ago, Stone said. It was explained to me in great detail by your Mr. Barrier.
There was a knock on the door, and the butler entered.
Mr. Olaku has just had a telephone message, he said. The county fire inspectors are at his factory and wish to speak with him there at once.
"Mr. Rosanna was just leaving," Stone said. "Please show him the door and tell the security people to shoot him if he tarries." Owaki stalked from the room and would have slammed the door behind him if the butler had not already closed it softly. Stone and Meg burst into laughter. "Oh, that was wonderful," Meg said, wiping tears away.
"I think he got the message," Stone replied, "and now he will send us a message, and in so doing, we can hope he makes a mistake, and we will do our best to be ready for him."
53. Stone walked out his front door in time to watch a black Mercedes Maybach depart his house in a spray of gravel. Carl Atkins, the security man, was watching, too.
"I guess your idea was to have him go away mad," he said.
"Exactly, Carl. And now I think we must prepare for him to respond."
"From what I've heard of him in the security business, he loves revenge, among all other things."
"Have you been in touch with the local constabulary?" Stone asked.
"Just once, when we arrived."
"That inspector, you know, is now the chief constable, and he wants to be helpful if he can."
"Then use him and his people to the hilt," Stone said, "and I will find a way to thank him later."
"Certainly, sir. And may I have your permission to request another 6 men to be sent down from London?"
"If you think we need them. And I think it would be a good idea to speak to the manager of our hotel and see what you can learn from him and his staff about Owaki's intentions."
"His car didn't head in that direction," Atkins said. "I think he may be visiting his car factory."
"I'm sure of it," Stone said. His cell phone rang, and he answered. "Hello?"
"Good afternoon, my dear," Felicity said. "I wanted to thank you for a delightful evening, though I was a little worse for the wear this morning."
"A condition I share," Stone replied. "I've just had a visit from Selwyn Owaki, who came to make a business proposal and left very, very unhappy, after a call to him requesting his attention to some county fire officials at his factory."
"I should think he might hear from more than one county department before the day is out," she said. "And tomorrow, with any luck at all, he may be summoned to the Home Secretary's office to explain why he should not be expelled from the country because of bad business practices and his indifference to the safety of his staff."
"You are a perfect angel," Stone said.
"We can discuss that on another occasion," Felicity said. "But in the meantime, I think you should prepare yourself for a further visit for Mr. Owaki or his associates."
"I have already taken steps," Stone said, "which reminds me, I must make a call to the hotel manager regarding his most infamous guest."
"Go, then. See you soon."
"Yes, indeed."
Stone called the hotel and asked to speak to the manager.
"Yes, Mr. Barrington," the man said.
"I hope business is good," Stone said.
"It is very good, sir. We are maintaining an occupancy rate in the region of 95%.
"I'm delighted to hear it. However, I'm calling to ask you to free up some space, that occupied by a Mr. Owaki and perhaps some of his associates."
"Ah, yes, a large suite and 2 smaller rooms. You would like them all to vacate?"
"I would."
"How soon?"
"With immediate effect."
"As you wish, sir. What reason shall I give Mr. Owaki?"
"Tell him that your headquarters have instructed you to evict him, and that he and his associates will oblige the management by leaving quietly."
"Certainly, sir. Would you like us to pack his luggage?"
"What a good idea." "Neatly, of course. Then set it on the front steps for collection on his return. How much is his bill?"
"They arrived only yesterday, sir, so it's right at £3,500 so far."
"Hand him his bill marked paid, and send a copy to my New York office, which will reimburse you."
"As you wish, Mr. Barrington. I'll see to it immediately."
"Oh,
Stone said. If you should find any weapons when you are packing his things, retain them and turn them over to the chief of the local constabulary, and be sure to tell Mr. Rowaki or his representative that you have done so.
It will be done, sir. Is there anything else? Anything at all?
Thank you. That will do it, Stone said. And I will favorably mention your cooperation to the main office at the first opportunity.
How very kind of you, sir.
Goodbye. Stone hung up. Carl Atkins, who had overheard the conversation, was laughing quietly.
Good idea to disarm them, Mr. Barrington.
We must try and keep the peace, Carl. By the way, I'm reliably informed that Mr. Owaki and his party will be told to leave the country tomorrow.
I don't know how you arranged that, sir, but I admire your skills and your connections.
Stone turned to the butler, who had been present the whole time.
Would you please ask the head groom to saddle two of the horses for Miss Harmon and me, and to bring them around front?
Yes, sir.
And would you let Miss Harmon know that we are going riding?
Immediately, sir.
Anything else I can do for you, Mr. Barrington? Atkins asked.
Yes, you can loan me a compact firearm and a holster, Stone said.
Right away, sir.
Atkins left at a trot for the cottage where his crew were staying. Stone's phone rang.
Hello?
It's Dino. Are you still alive?
Perfectly so, Stone replied.
I mean, I heard that Owaki is in your neighborhood.
Meg and I met with him only a few minutes ago, and with the able assistance of Dame Felicity, we have rattled his cage sufficiently for him to be out of the country tomorrow.
Which means he'll be coming back into my jurisdiction, Dino said. Thanks a lot.
I expect so. Can you think of any way to make his arrival memorable?
I expect so. I'll alert U.S. Customs at Teterboro, which is where he lands his Gulfstream. Might they be carrying any weapons?
Perhaps, but I have managed to put some of them beyond his reach. Perhaps a strip search by Customs might turn up anything he has left.
I'll suggest a full cavity search, too, Dino said. Those Customs guys love that. When you're coming back?
I don't know. A day or two, I guess. Meg has to close on her new apartment.
I spoke to the head of the committee, Dino said. She's a shoo-in.
I'll tell her. She'll like that. They said goodbye and hung up. 54. As Meg left the house, a stableman walked around the corner, leading two beautifully groomed horses.
"Yours is the mare, mine the gelding," Stone said.
"I hope I can tell which is which," she said, lifting a leg so that the groom could hoist her into the saddle.
Stone managed on his own.
"We'll walk them for a couple of hundred yards to let them loosen up," he said, and they did so.
At the end of that, Stone's gelding was champing at the bit, and a tap of the heel into his flank achieved a comfortable gallop. Meg pulled up alongside him.
"Wall coming up," Stone said. "Are you up for that?"
"Sure I am," she said.
They took the stone wall that divided Windward Hall from the hotel's estate and galloped across the acreage of its front lawn.
"Magnificent house," Meg said. "You should have bought that one."
"I wasn't looking for a stately home," Stone said. "And there are at least 60 staff there, not counting the hotel keepers."
He noted that two bellmen were piling up luggage at the bottom of the front steps.
"Mr. Owaki appears to be checking out," he said, as the black Maybach pulled up to the front of the house.
He edged the gelding up into a full run, and Meg kept right up. They took another wall, then pulled up into some trees to rest the horses. Stone got down and took a small bag from its place behind the saddle.
"Would you like a beer?"
"What a good idea."
They sat down with their backs against a tree and drank the cold lager. I would jump you, Meg said, if riding clothes weren't so difficult to deal with.
They'll come off easily enough when we get back, Stone said, kissing her lightly.
I'll look forward to watching.
Stone gave her a leg up onto the mare, then got onto the gelding.
Then Meg pointed back to where they had come from.
Look! She shouted. Stone pulled his mount around to face Windward Hall.
From the rear of the house a column of black smoke was rising.
He dug his heels into the gelding. Come on! We'll run them the whole way!
The horses sprang forward and hardly noticed the stone wall when they topped it. Stone could hear a siren in the distance, and as they drew up in front of the house, a fire truck drove around to the rear. Stone and Meg jumped down and handed their horses to the waiting groom. Then she followed him up the front steps into the house and down a hall toward the kitchen. The fire was not inside, but at the rear of the building. They ran out the kitchen door and found flames from some unidentifiable pile of material licking at the rear wall. The firemen were spooling out their hoses. Stone and Meg watched anxiously from the rear as the firemen applied water to the burning pile. Then, when that failed to stanch the flames, they produced extinguishers and sprayed it with foam. Gradually, the flames lessened and finally stopped, buried under a white mass of fire suppressant.
"Thank God," Stone muttered.
"Do you think this has something to do with Owaki?" Meg asked.
"Who else hates me enough to want to burn down my house?" Stone asked.
"Well, there must be a woman or two," Meg said, "even in England." The firemen had removed their protective gear and were being fed sandwiches and tea by the kitchen staff.
"Do you know what the burning material was?" Stone asked their chief.
"Never seen anything like it," the man replied, between munches. "They had stuff like that during the war, you know, in the Blitz. The devil to put out. Black stuff. Come to think of it, we were up at the motor car factory earlier today, and I saw some black stuff piled up next to the trash removal place. I'll have my investigator look into that."
Stone thanked them all. Then he and Meg went upstairs and undressed, and she climbed into the shower with him, soaping his body and scrubbing him with a rough mitt. Then he did the same for her. They toweled each other off and fell into bed.
Half an hour later, the phone buzzed.
Yes?
"Mr. Barrington, it's Atkins. We had a call from the fire inspector, and he confirms arson, using some sort of tar-like substance as an accelerant. They're looking for Owaki."
"Tell them to try the Home Secretary's office in Whitehall," Stone replied. "I believe Owaki may be having a chat with that gentleman."
"Excuse me, sir, but how would you know that?"
"Like you, Carl, I have my intelligence sources."
"Of course, sir."
Stone hung up and called Dino.
"Machete."
"It's Stone. Owaki set fire to my house earlier this afternoon."
"Did the bobbies catch the bastard?"
"He already had a date with the Home Secretary set up by Felicity. My guess is he is, or will be soon, on his Gulf Stream, winging his way west. Is there some opportunity for an international warrant?"
"I can look into that, but the evidence would have to be very strong for them to get an extradition warrant from the U.S.
"Oh, well, the hell with it," Stone said. "It will probably be easier to charge him with something in the States. That way he can be denied bail, and will have to sit out the wait for trial in jail."
"That sounds just wonderful," Dino said. "Do you have a charge on the tip of your tongue?"
Not yet. Maybe they'll find something actionable on his airplane when it gets to Teterboro."
"I'll give Customs a call and ask them to be particularly thorough. I suppose I should give the U.S. attorney a heads-up, too, just in case."
"It couldn't hurt," Stone said. "Hang on." He covered the phone and turned to Meg. "Home tomorrow, okay with you?"
"Yes, I had a call from Margot, and my board meeting is now on the day after, and the closing the day after that, if they don't hate me on sight.
Stone turned back to the phone. We'll fly tomorrow. Why don't you and Viv come to dinner at my house if she's back from wherever she is?
She will be, Dino said. Call me when you get in.
They both hung up.
It seems we have an hour to spare before we have to dress for dinner, Stone said.
Is there something you'd like to do?
Oh, yes, she replied.
55.
Carl Atkins called.
We have intruders on the estate, he said. I have a party out searching for them now.
Carl, Stone said, please send somebody down to the airstrip and make sure the airplane is safe and fully fueled. Take the fuel caps off and look inside. They should be full right up to the top.
Atkins got on his radio and gave orders. 5 minutes later, he got a call back.
The airplane is secure and already fully fueled, he said, and I've posted 2 men to guard it. Are you leaving immediately?
No, but we'll go at dawn tomorrow. We'll be there before first light to do a pre-flight and get the airplane positioned at the end of the runway.
And what will be your destination?
Santa Maria in the Azores. We'll refuel there, then fly to St. John's in Newfoundland, refuel, then to Teterboro. We'll be there late afternoon, Eastern time.
Got it. Everything will be ready before sunup.
Stone explained the plan to Meg.
How far is it to the Azores? She asked.
1,500 nautical miles, he replied.
Do we have that much range? It will be upwind, won't it?
We can always divert to Lisbon halfway if the range doesn't work. It will depend on the winds. I have at least 2,000 miles of range, maybe considerably more, because of the new winglets I had installed a couple of months ago.
Okay, whatever you say.
They had a candlelit dinner in the library, then packed and got to bed early. They were up at 4 a.m. and at the airstrip half an hour later. They stowed the luggage, then Stone did his pre-flight inspection by flashlight. They got aboard and were towed to the end of the runway, where Stone completed his checklists, then started the engines. As the first rays of the sun showed, he pushed the throttles forward, and they began to roll down the runway. Halfway down the strip, Stone saw some sort of commotion near the hangar, and there was the flash of gunfire. He gulped and kept rolling, his reasoning being that if he stopped, the airplane would surely be fired on, but if they took off, he had a better chance of making it unscathed. If the airplane was hit and failed to pressurize, they could fly to Southampton, a short distance away, and land there. Stone eased back on the yoke, and the nose wheel left the ground, followed shortly by the main landing gear. He flew southeast, checking the cabin pressure gauge, until they were at 10,000 feet along the way, calling air traffic control for a clearance. They were cleared to flight level 400 and turned on course. 20 minutes later, Stone leveled off, set the throttles for cruise, and let the airspeed climb. When they were at 400 knots, he checked the range ring, which showed they would reach Santa Maria with a 150-mile reserve of fuel.
"We're going to be fine on fuel," he said to Meg.
"Is there any way Owaki can find out where we're going?"
"Yes, but we'll be in Santa Maria, refueled and off again before he could give chase."
"What about St. John's? Could he have us met there?"
"Half an hour out of St. John's, I'll change our destination to Gander. We'll be in and out of there in half an hour, and he wouldn't dare try to pull anything at Teterboro. The police would be all over him. Fred and the Strategic Services people will meet us there and escort us to the house."
"Good. My meeting with the co-op board is tomorrow morning."
They rolled into Stone's garage at 5 p.m., tired and happy to be home.
Bob was beside himself with joy to have Stone back, and Joan was pretty happy, too.
"I hear you had some aggravation across the pond," she said.
"Don't worry. Nobody's tried to burn down this house yet."
"I'm glad to hear it."
"Dino called."
"Call him back and tell him we're still expecting him and Viv for dinner, and let Helene know they're coming."
Joan went to her work.
Stone pulled the drapes in the master bedroom and achieved something like darkness. They fell asleep without further ado, unusual because they had become accustomed to further ado. Stone had been asleep for an hour when the phone rang. Automatically, he picked up.
"What?" "It's Dino. I thought you'd like to know that Owaki's Gulfstream 650 landed at Teterboro about 7 p.m., and a squadron of customs people greeted them. They took the airplane apart, and in the rear luggage compartment, under the floor panels, they found half a dozen Kalashnikovs and a dozen handguns plus ammo. They took Owaki in."
"How long before he's out?"
"That depends on you."
"On me?"
"Yeah. There'll be a bail hearing at 11 tomorrow morning at the federal courthouse, and we need you to testify to your knowledge of Owaki. If Customs and the FBI can get the judge to deny bail, he'll spend the next few months on Rikers Island."
"I think that might be character building for him," Stone said.
"In the big courtroom. Don't be late."
"I won't." He hung up and went back to sleep. Early the following morning, he felt a hand creeping up his thigh. He glanced at the bedside clock. 9:30.
"Hold it right there, missy," he said. "I'm due in federal court at 11, so if you want to come, get dressed quickly."
He freed himself, leaped out of bed, and thence into a shower. By 10:15, munching on a muffin, he was in the rear seat of the Bentley with Meg and headed downtown. At 10:45, his phone rang.
"It's Dino. Where the fuck are you?"
"Enjoying the traffic in your fine city. Why didn't you give me a motorcycle escort?"
"Get your ass here, pronto."
56. Stone got out of the Bentley, leaving Fred at the wheel, and Meg, who didn't want to be present in the courtroom, in the rear seat. He walked into the courtroom at the stroke of 11 on the big clock over the bench.
Dino glared at him from the front row of spectator seats and waved him forward.
Stone took a seat. He saw Owaki's back ahead of him, next to a silver-haired attorney in a $10,000 suit.
"It's about fucking time,"
Dino growled under his breath. "What are you doing here anyway?" Stone asked. "You're not a fed."
"Once in a while, I just like to enjoy myself, you know."
The bailiff called for all to rise, and the judge entered the courtroom and sat down.
"Call the first case," she said, and the clerk yelled, "Bail hearing for one Selwyn Owakow."
Stone suppressed a laugh, and the judge looked at him oddly. Stone had known her for a long time, but not for some years. He gave her a slight nod. She turned toward the federal prosecutor.
"Counsel?"
The prosecutor stood.
"Your Honor, the defendant, one Selwyn Owaki, I believe I have the name right, last night arrived at Teterboro Airport in New Jersey aboard a Gulfstream 650, an aircraft valued at something on the order of $60 million, upon which a search warrant, signed by Your Honor, was served by the United States Customs Service. Their search was fruitful, producing some 24 illegal weapons, among them Russian automatic assault weapons. The defendant is an infamous weapons dealer and extremely wealthy. He owns 3 jet aircraft with intercontinental range, the Gulfstream having a range of more than 8,000 nautical miles, and he has large quantities of cash in banks around the world.
He has two passports, and thus is a monumental candidate for risk of flight, as well as being of poor character. We request that he be held without bail until trial.
Do you have any witnesses to call on the question of risk of flight or character?
Indeed I do, Judge. I call Mr. Stone Barrington, who is a member of the New York State Bar, and who has experience of Mr. Iwaki's character and conduct.
Swear the witness, the judge said. Stone took the oath and had a seat. The prosecutor consulted his notes.
Mr. Barrington, how long have you known Mr. Selwyn Iwaki?
Too long, Stone replied, glancing at his watch. Almost 36 hours. The courtroom burst into laughter, and the judge smirked.
All right, she said. Get on with it. And how did you come to make Mr. Iwaki's acquaintance?
I have a home in England, and I was there for a few days of relaxation, when Mr. Iwaki appeared at my door, uninvited. By way of context, I should explain that Mr. Iwaki engineered the theft of some very valuable software belonging to a client of mine, and in the process, two murders were committed. Iwaki's attorney was on his feet.
Objection! Facts not in evidence.
Goes to character, the prosecutor said.
This is not a trial. I'll allow it.
The software was recovered, and I removed it and my client from the country after receiving threats from henchmen of Mr. Iwaki's. To my surprise, he turned up there, in England, where he had already bought a factory to manufacture the product of the stolen software, which certainly goes to intent. He offered either to buy the software or sell the factory. When my client declined to sell the software and made a derisory offer for the factory, Mr. Iwaki became incensed and began to make vile threats. I asked him to leave, and he did so angrily. Less than an hour later, a fire was set at my home, which the local fire department declared to be arson. I made plans to depart England the following morning before dawn, and gunshots were fired at my airplane while it was still on the private runway.
And you attribute these actions to Mr. Iwaki?
I have no other enemies who would threaten my life and that of my client.
Do you know whether Mr. Iwaki had any interaction with the authorities during his stay in Britain?
I am reliably informed that he was deported from the United Kingdom yesterday by the Home Secretary, with immediate effect. He was escorted to the airport, put aboard his airplane, then he left for Teterboro, where U.S. Customs met him and served their warrant.
I have no further evidence at this time, the prosecutor said.
Mr. Kenneth Conway, I believe, the judge said to Iwaki's attorney. Do you have any questions for the witness?
The lawyer rose.
None, Your Honor, but I have a statement.
Proceed. Your Honor, Mr. Selwyn Iwaki is widely known around the world as a distributor of defense materials to legitimately constituted governments. He holds a United States passport, has maintained a home in New York City for many years, and has been a model citizen. This is the first occasion on which he has been arrested. He is no risk of flight, and will willingly surrender his passport while awaiting trial.
All of them? The judge asked, getting a laugh.
He has only two.
That we know of, the prosecutor interjected, gaining a warning glance from the judge.
What's the other one? She asked.
Turkish, Your Honor.
Is Mr. Iwaki a native of either the United States or Turkey?
No, Your Honor. He is naturalized in both.
Why does he have so many airplanes? She asked.
He does most of his business internationally and must always have an aircraft available.
Do either of you wish to call Mr. Iwaki to testify?
No, Your Honor, the prosecutor said.
No.
The defense attorney replied.
Do either of you have any other evidence to submit in this matter?
No,
the defense attorney said. Yes, Your Honor, the prosecutor said. He walked forward holding a thick file. This contains facts about Mr. Iwaki and his businesses from many sources. Your Honor might find it interesting reading. I have a copy for the defense. His assistant handed one to Conway. The judge opened the file and leafed through it for a minute or two. Very well, she said. I'll rule. Both attorneys and Iwaki stood. The motion to deny bail until trial is granted. The defendant is remanded to the custody of the Federal Detention Center until trial. She leafed through her calendar. I will set a date of 3 months from today at 10 a.m. for trial, she said. The defense requests leave to file an appeal, the attorney said. File away, the judge said, banging her gavel. This case is adjourned for the duration. A court officer handcuffed Iwaki and led him away. The prosecutor came over to Stone, shook his hand, and thanked him. How do you rate the chances of his appeal? Stone asked. Not very good, the man replied.
Let's get out of here, Dino said.
57. Stone and Dino walked out of the courthouse and down the long front steps. Stone's Bentley was idling at the curb, and Dino's official SUV pulled up behind it as they approached.
I don't guess you need a lift, Dino said.
No, Fred and Meg are waiting for me, Stone replied. Then he stopped and looked at his car. Fred was slumped over the steering wheel, and the rear seat was empty. The driver's window was down. Fred liked his fresh air. Hang on, Stone said. He opened the driver's door, and Fred fell into his arms.
Do we need an ambulance?
Dino asked. Stone examined Fred's head, but found no wounds. Then he saw a drop of blood trickle down his neck. We're gonna need an ambulance and a lot more, Stone said. Meg has been taken. Dino ran to his car and gave the driver a request for an ambulance, a description of Meg, and orders for an APB. Then he returned to Stone.
An APB is out, and an ambulance is on its way.
Stone felt his cell phone vibrate in his pocket, and he looked at the phone. The caller was Fred Flicker.
We've got contact, Stone said, then answered the call.
Yes?
Do I have to tell you what we want?
A voice said. Yes, you do, Stone replied. He wanted to hear more of the voice.
We want the thumb drive. As soon as we've verified the authenticity and the efficacy of the software, we will return the lady unharmed. The time is now noon. We will expect a call from you by 2 p.m. stating that you are ready to turn over the drive. If it is not in our hands by 2:30 p.m., you may locate pieces of the lady's body in the East River. Do you understand?
Yes, Stone said, and the man hung up. It was Stanislav Beria, Stone said. You can add him to your APB. 6'1", 170, dark hair.
Are you sure?
I thought I recognized his voice, and as he continued talking, I was sure of it.
What does he want?
A thumb drive containing the software of the designs and specifications of Meg's self-driving car.
Where is it?
On a thumb drive, in my office safe.
How much time do we have?
He wants me to call him on Fred's phone by 2 p.m. He says she'll be dead by 2:30 if we haven't handed over the thumb drive by then. By the time the ambulance arrived, Fred was awake and standing up, though he appeared a bit woozy. He waved off medical attention.
I'll be all right in a few minutes, he said. Nothing wrong with me that fresh air won't fix. Come with me, Dino said.
Dino ordered the detective in the front passenger seat of his car to drive Stone's car, which was still running, put Fred in the passenger seat, Then he gave the detective Stone's address. The car moved out, and Dino made a call, reinforcing the APB and adding Stanislav Beria to it.
"Also, post a car and two men outside the Russian UN mission, in case Beria returns there."
Stone tugged at his sleeve.
"What?"
"Add the gorilla Ivanov to the APB. 6'3" or 4, 250, black hair, deep 5 o'clock shadow." Dino did so, then hung up.
"Didn't we arrest that guy?"
"Yes, but he got released, and you couldn't hold Beria because he holds a diplomatic passport."
"What phone number did they give you?"
"They took Fred's phone."
"What's his number?"
Stone gave it to him. Dino made another call and said to whoever answered,
"This is Bichetti. I need a location on a cell phone number."
He gave them the number.
"How long?" "All right, I'll call it then."
He hung up.
"They need 10 minutes to get set up, and I have to keep them on the line for 2 minutes.
They continued on toward Stone's house, occasionally using the siren to get through the traffic. "Dino," Stone said.
"Shut up, I'm thinking."
Stone shut up.
"Okay," Dino said finally. "What do you want?"
Stone thought about it. "I forget."
"I've got a plan," Dino said,
then told him what it was.
"Well, that sounds great, Dino, but what if it doesn't work?"
"Then Meg is dead,"
Dino replied.
"I'm not willing to risk that."
"Where was the thumb drive before it got into your pocket?"
"In the library safe at my house in England."
"And you said when you were testifying that Iwaki had been thrown out of the country?"
"Yes."
"What about Beria and Ivanov?"
"I don't know whether they were in England. I only saw Iwaki at my house, and when his luggage was being loaded into his car."
"I don't understand," Dino said. "Luggage?"
"Iwaki was staying at the Arrington Hotel next door to my house, and I called the manager and had him thrown out. Meg and I were riding by on horseback, and I saw a couple of men loading bags into Iwaki's car."
"Was either of them Beria or Ivanov?"
"I don't think so. I only got a glimpse of them."
"I wish you were more observant,"
Dino said with disgust. "Gee, I'm sorry. I didn't know this was going to come up. What is it you want in England?"
"Somebody who can go to your house, open the safe, and get the thumb drive."
"But the thumb drive isn't there. It's in my safe."
"Not that thumb drive, dummy."
"I don't get it." Dino's phone rang.
"Bichetti?" "Okay, I'm calling the number in 30 seconds.
He hung up, glanced at his watch, and tapped in Fred's number. At 30 seconds, he pressed the call button.
"Here we go,"
he said.
"It's ringing."
58. Stone watched Dino's face as the phone rang. It betrayed no emotion.
"Hello,"
Dino said.
"I'm calling on behalf of Stone Barrington. What is it you want?"
He listened carefully, nodding.
"Is that all?"
He listened again.
"I'm afraid there'll be a delay. That item is not in this country."
He listened.
"The item is in a safe in the library of Mr. Barrington's house in England."
Stone could hear an angry voice replying. Dino continued to listen.
"Hold on. I'll find out how it can be opened."
He left the phone near his lips as he talked to Stone.
"Who knows how to get into that safe?"
"I do," Stone replied.
"No, I mean somebody else who can get into it. Somebody in England."
"The manager of the estate, Major Bug, has the combination. I will instruct him to open it on presentation of a password."
"And what is the password?"
"Let me think."
"Not too long,"
Dino whispered, his hand over the phone.
"The password is Arrington."
"Did you get that?"
Dino asked. He spelled the name carefully.
Now, when will you release Miss Harmon?
He listened.
Surely Mr. Iwaki has someone in England who can pop over to the house and see Major Bug. Well, how long, then? I would like to point out that Mr. Barrington has followed your instructions explicitly. You have no further reason to hold Miss Harmon.
He listened.
By the way, what is your name?
Stone heard the click when they hung up.
Well, Dino said, that should be long enough for my people to get a location. By the way, Stone, you'd better call Major Bug and ask him to put a thumb drive in your safe and to open it for whoever gives him the password.
Dino dialed a number on his own cell phone. Stone called Major Bug, who was probably having his tea interrupted, and told him what must be done.
"What is a thumb drive?"
Bug asked. "It's a small computer device about the size of a thumb, hence the name."
"I don't have one. Where would I get it?"
"At a computer shop. Is there one in the village?"
"Yes, a small one. It's a small device."
Could you send someone there immediately and buy one of the largest capacity available?
Yes, of course.
I'll call you in a few minutes, and we'll do a data transfer from my computer to the thumb drive.
Yes, my assistant knows how to do that, I believe.
Thank you, Major Bug. Dino was still on the phone.
Keep that connection alive, he said to his officer. Don't let it get away from you.
He hung up. Did they get a location for Fred's cell phone?
Yes, it's a few feet from your house.
What?
Apparently in a car parked in front of your house. They'll track it if it moves.
He spoke to his driver.
You can keep the siren on now. How long?
10 minutes if the traffic isn't too bad.
Okay.
Dino called his office and ordered a car situated at each end of Stone's block. Then he sat back in his seat and appeared to relax.
"Why are you so relaxed?" Stone asked.
"I'm always relaxed when I've done all I can do. Can you think of anything else I should do right this minute?"
"No, I guess not."
"Then I'm going to relax. I might even take a nap."
He put his head against the back of the seat and closed his eyes.
"I wish I could relax like that," Stone said.
"It takes practice."
Dino's cell phone rang, and he answered it.
"Bichetti."
He listened for a moment.
"Well, shit," he said. "Call me back when you've reestablished." "What?" "Okay."
He hung up.
"They lost the signal when the guy hung up. I'll call it again."
He pressed the button and gazed out the window.
"Hello. This is the same person who phoned a moment ago. Do you remember me?" "Yes, that's the one. Listen, Major Bug has left his office for the day, and someone has been sent to his home to get him to return to the house. It's going to take about an hour, since he lives half an hour away from the house. Have you got that?" "Okay. Then let's talk again in an hour, unless you'd just like to chat for a while. I've got plenty of time."
Dino put down the phone.
"Goodbye, Mr. Barrier."
He hung up. "I'm not surprised they lost the connection," Stone said. "Were they able to get a fix again? Are they still sitting in front of my house?" Dino's phone rang.
"Bichetti."
"Which way?"
"Are you on it?" "Thanks."
Dino sat back and relaxed again.
"The car left your house and turned downtown on 2nd Avenue. We are in pursuit."
"But you've lost the connection again?"
"Yeah, but he said to call back in a couple of minutes, so they can get a new location."
Dino put his head back onto the headrest and appeared to doze. Stone waited impatiently, then jabbed Dino with an elbow. Dino didn't open his eyes.
"Yeah?"
"It's been a couple of minutes. Make the call."
"It hasn't been more than half a minute," Dino said.
"I timed it with my watch," Stone lied.
"Oh, all right."
D Dino called the number.
"Hi, Mr. Barrier. How's everything going?"
He held the phone away from his ear while the man on the other end shouted.
"Why shouldn't I call you Mr. Barrier?" Dino said. "That's your name, isn't it?"
Another torrent of shouting.
"I mean, have you sent somebody to the Barrington house in England to get the thumb drive?" "Well, he should be back at the house inside an hour. How's the weather where you are?" "Oh, good. I hear it's raining like hell in England, but then it usually is. Tell your guy to drive carefully. Those country roads can get slippery when they're wet."
Dino put down his phone.
They hung up again. Some people just can't carry on a conversation, you know.
"Yes, I know," Stone said. Dino's phone rang.
"Bichetti, did you get a new location?" "Why the hell would they do that?" "Okay, I'll call them again in a couple of minutes."
He hung up. "Now what?"
"Now they're on First Avenue, headed uptown. Every time they hang up, we lose the connection. I'll call back in a couple of minutes, and this time I want to see you timing it."
Stone pressed the start button on his Rolex Daytona.
"Okay, I'm timing it." "Let me know when it's 2 minutes," he said.
"I'll do that," Stone said.
"And we need to go to my house." "Why?"
"I want to send Bug some data from the thumb drive so when they check it out, it will appear to work." 59. Meg woke up slowly, realizing that she was in the luggage compartment of an SUV, with a pull-out cover closed over her head, cutting out much of the light. Her hands were secured behind her, her handbag chain around her neck, and her ankles were taped together. Her handbag lay about an inch from her nose. There were two things she immediately wanted from the handbag, a little sewing kit and a small .380 pistol that Stone had given her from his safe when she had complained about feeling in danger. She would get some satisfaction from telling Stone that she had been right. She heard a cell phone ring in one end of a conversation. She supposed Stone was on the other end. The talker hung up and said angrily,
"He keeps calling me Mr. Barrier."
"Why not?"
another male voice asked.
"It's your name." "Yes, but he's not supposed to know it."
Then, for reasons unknown to her, they switched to Russian. Meg managed to get her small handbag between her teeth and drag it to a spot near her head, in the center of the compartment that contained her. When they reached the house, Stone told Fred to put the Bentley in the garage, just to give him something to do. Then he took Dino into his office.
"What's going on?" Joan asked as they passed her desk.
"Barrier has taken Meg," he replied, and continued into his office. He sat at his desk and turned to his computer, then glanced at his watch.
"Time's up," he said to Dino. "Call Fred's number again."
Dino pressed the button and waited for an answer, which came quickly.
"All right, Mr. Barrier, we're making progress. Major Bug has been summoned and is on the way to Mr. Barrington's house. He should be there in about half an hour. It's still raining hard over there, by the way, so let's hope he doesn't drive into a ditch." "Okay, okay, I'll call you in half an hour."
He hung up.
"Barrier doesn't like chatting with me."
"How do you know it's raining in England?"
"It's always raining in England," Dino said. "Also, I needed something to talk about to keep him on the line long enough for my people to get another fix."
Stone called Major Bug's cell phone.
"Mr. Barrington, I have obtained a thumb drive from the computer shop in the village. What shall I do with it?"
"Please plug it into your computer's USB receptacle," Stone said. "I want to send you some files." He took the thumb drive from his office safe, plugged it into his computer, and established contact with Bug's machine. He chose the first file from each of four sections of the files on his computer and transmitted them to Bug's computer as different documents.
"There," he said. "All done. Now, please take the thumb drive to the safe and lock it inside. Someone will come for it, then you can open the safe and hand it over."
"Of course, sir," Bug said. "Will you be calling again?"
"When the transaction is complete and the person is left, follow him out and get a description of his car and the number plate before he drives away."
"Yes, sir."
"Are you sure you don't wish me to capture the man?"
"Not necessary. Just call me back with the car's description and the number plate."
"Yes, sir."
Meg managed to maneuver into a sitting position with her back against the rear of the SUV's back seat and her handbag near her hands. She managed to unzip it and find the sewing kit, then unzip that and find a small pair of scissors. Cutting the duct tape that held her hands was harder than she had expected, but she managed to free her hands, then her feet. She then opened the handbag, found the small pistol, pumped around into the chamber, and set the safety. Now she examined the latch of the rear door of the vehicle and decided she could open it from the inside. She tried to relax while she waited for the car to stop for a traffic light.
"Where was the last fix on Fred's cell phone?" Stone asked.
"While you were talking to Bug, they seemed to be heading for the FDR Drive," Dino said.
That highway ran along the East River, north and south.
"All right, time to call them again," Stone said. Dino made the call.
"Hi, Mr. Barrier," he said. "It's me again, remember? Well, sure, I'm hard to forget. I just wanted you to know that Major Bug has arrived at Mr. Barrington's house and is waiting there for your man to come and get the thumb drive." "No, no, he's unarmed. He's happy to give your man the drive. He won't be a problem. How are you doing? Are you making progress toward where you're going to let Miss Harmon out of the car?" "Thanks. I appreciate that."
Dino hung up.
"He hung up again, but that should have been long enough for a fix. He says he'll let Meg go as soon as his man in England calls and says the drive checks out."
Dino's phone rang again.
"Bichetti." "No shit. All right. I want every unmarked vehicle you can muster there as soon as possible. No sirens or lights, and don't bunch up in a pack. Go."
He hung up. "Where is Meg?" Stone asked.
"Apparently, Barrier left the FDR Drive and drove onto Randall's Island in the East River. And now he's on Ward's Island, where the garbage collector's school is."
"The garbage collectors have a school?"
"Well, sure. They've got to learn to make the truck work and how to load it properly and how to empty it and all that."
"Who knew?" Stone said.
The SUV had not stopped, but it had slowed down a lot. Meg decided not to wait for it to come to a halt. She would just roll out onto the ground and hope for the best. She reached for the door latch and struggled with it, but it didn't work. She tried to retract the cover over her head so she would have access to the rear seat, but that didn't work either. She would have to wait until someone unlocked the rear hatch from the outside. The SUV had made a turn and was now on a rougher road with lots of potholes. Where the hell could she be? Then she heard brush scraping along the sides of the vehicle. The car stopped, and she could hear the two men arguing, still in Russian. She wished she knew what the hell they were talking about. She heard the two front doors open, then slam shut. The two men continued to shout at each other as they walked along the two sides of the vehicle toward the rear hatch. Meg scrunched down with her feet against the hatch and her head against the back of the rear seat, then flipped the safety with her thumb and held the weapon in both hands, pointed at the hatch. Then the hatch opened, and daylight flooded in.
60. The rear hatch swung up, and two men stood there, staring at the gun in her hand.
"Kill her,"
the slim one said to the gorilla. He took a step toward the car.
Meg recalled